Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going to a city that's set on a hill. Its ruler and maker is the Lord God above. Oh, I'm going to a city, and it's set on a hill. And someday I'll be in heaven, and there'll be no sorrow there.
Hello, everybody. God bless you today. This is the day the Lord has made, and we will rejoice and be glad in it. Amen. We have a very special guest for you today. Our guest will be talking about her experience in the Jim Jones cult, the People's Temple in Jonestown, and how she survived. Laura Johnston Cole. So I'm sure she has many interesting things to tell us, and I think we can all learn a lesson from what happened in Jonestown and how Laura survived this. I can hardly wait to talk to her. So I'm going to bring her on, and I also want to mention that it is a live call-in show, so the chat room is open, and if you do have a question for Laura, the call-in number is 914-338-1638. So please call in if you have a question. Hello, Laura.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Thank you for coming on. And I am really looking forward to talking with you today and getting your testimony of how you survived Jonestown and the Jim Jones cult. But I wanted to introduce you to the listening audience, and if you don't mind, give us a little bit about your background.
Okay. I was born in Washington, D.C. in 1947, and I actually, you know, I was always an activist, politically active. My mother was, you know, very involved with, you know, politics. And so in a way that kind of set me up to have a different point of view about the 1960s, right when I was finishing high school and going off to college, we had our worst decade of violence here at home in the United States, because we had like Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and many other people shot and killed. And so in a way that set my tone, saying that I did not want the world to be run by bullies who shot down their opponents. Where does conversation and where does, you know, a more enlightened look at how we can fix the world's problems, where do I go from there?
Yeah, so I grew up in the 60s too. I was a teenager in the 1960s, so you're just a few years older than me, so I've been there too.
And so, I mean, in a way that one period of time did set me on a search of trying to figure out how can I impact the world without being a victim of it, you know. I tried a few things that didn't work for me. I worked with the Black Panthers, sending out free breakfast for a while. And I,
now, how did you get involved with the Black Panthers? And I didn't really know too much about their food program, but you don't hear that much about them now. But how did you get involved there?
Well, I worked in in the welfare department in Connecticut, and so I worked at a housing project, and the Panthers decided to open a free breakfast right next door in this area that had, you know, really dire poverty. And so they would go every morning and get there at 4:30 in the morning and set up an elaborate breakfast and then feed these kids before they went off to school. And it was just a wonderful program. And they were doing it all over the country, but I was fortunate that they were right next door to where I needed to be at work at 8. So I just changed my schedule and started going in and helping with the breakfast.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was such a great all around, because here you had role models feeding kids, getting them ready to school and to learn, and, you know, they had modeling. It was just a great program. And so that went on really for 5 or 10 years around the country in different places. But I participated in the one in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And,
yeah.
you know, it kind of made my day. It set the tone of my day as being, you know what, I'm making a difference.
Yeah.
So I did that for a while. And then, you know, on a political level, I was right with him. But on a personal level, I was pretty naive. And so it
yeah.
didn't work out for me in the
yeah.
long run.
Yeah.
But I certainly supported that whole effort of people taking charge and not, you know, we were not going to be victims. People were going to feed their kids and get them ready and get them educated. I just thought that was great.
Yeah.
So then when that didn't work out, then I tried going to Woodstock because a lot of my friends around that time were deciding to just opt out and get out of politics and go into, you know, another kind of lifestyle. But you know, I tried that. That didn't really work for me. I wasn't looking for an escape. I was looking for more involvement. So I left the East Coast and I came to California and moved in with my sister. And she heard about Jim Jones and the work he was doing. He had an integrated community up in Redwood Valley. And, you know, and he was very politically active and had contacts with Angela Davis and Cesar Chavez and really all the leaders that I looked to once the leaders in the 60s had been shot and killed. I mean, he communicated and connected up with other people who were very progressive. So I did love that part. So that's kind of what drew me in. I was still looking for a way to make have an impact on the world, but without being a victim. And so I sort of thought of him as a father figure who was going to keep me out of the trouble that I kept getting myself into. My life was kind of disintegrating on a personal level, but politically I really liked what he was doing. So I
yeah.
thought, you know, here's a guy, he's going to be kind of a father figure. He's going to kind of protect me from my own, you know, bad choices that I had been making.
Well, yeah, it was kind of unrealistic, though, to think
absolutely.
That, you know, that a human being, and the way he presented himself, because I had looked at some YouTube videos this week of some of his sermons, but he presented himself as God and as father, as a father figure, and I'm going to protect you. But in the end, he didn't wind up protecting anyone.
Absolutely.
And so how, from the time then, what year was it then that you first joined up? Was it the People's Temple at the time?
Yes. So I joined People's Temple in 1970 in California. And so
okay.
I was part of People's Temple, and by day I worked at the Welfare Department. And at night I was very involved and stayed up till all hours of the morning, you know, night and morning, files, and I did security around Jim's house. I drove a Greyhound bus all over the country and into Canada and Mexico. I lived it communally. I headed up a commune so that, you know, people got, you know, had what they needed in the commune. So I was really involved in many aspects of people's
lives. Yeah, you really were. Yeah.
So for
especially
7 years,
being around his home.
Yes.
So then were you in the inner circle, so to speak? Were you, did he have an inner circle? Were you in communication with him daily?
You know, it's interesting. I've been thinking about this lately because different people have asked me. For the first 2 years that I was in People's Temple, he lived in Redwood Valley, and so did I. And so, you know, I would see, he'd have services 3 times a week, and then because I was around the grounds and on projects that he cared about and things like that, I'd see him, you know, 4 times a week, and he knew me and I knew him, and he kind of knew my strengths and my interests, because for 2 years, really we were in this close-knit community in Redwood Valley. And then
yeah.
he moved to San Francisco, and, you know, he took on, you know, took on the world. He got involved in politics and things like that. And so we lost, you know, we didn't have the same kind of, you know, I wasn't around him as much. I was never in his inner circle. Really, his preference was white girls a day over 18. And I had already, you know, been through a lot more than that. So,
I
didn't qualify. And so,
even at that time, he had a group of girls, kind of like groupies, that surrounded him?
Yeah, he did. You know, power creates a magnetism for people who want to be close to power. And
yeah,
it doesn't matter
true.
If it's a minister or a politician or a musician. There are people who, you know, want to be on, I mean, I guess that's where riding on the coattails comes from. There are people who really want to be around power. And so he would just select out of those who wanted to be around him, the people who would be in his inner circle. And in a way, they came to the most harm, because as he got more and more insane and, you know, mentally ill and more dysfunctional, the people closest to him were also infected by that same disease.
The thing, it must have been hard for him, I think, which led to the insanity later, for him to call himself God and to realize that he was human and he had all these human frailties. That's enough to drive anybody crazy. But,
the funny thing, though, about his manipulation of people, which is, you know, he has a lot, like many con men that I've met, certainly in my life, that, you know, a lot of times they're super smart, sometimes more smarter than some of the rest of us who are just kind of muddling through. And so he was smart enough to set up the environment around him. But I don't think that the way he used sex was a frailty. I think that he considered it just one more way to gain power over people.
Absolutely.
It wasn't a sexual issue with him. It was power.
Yeah, it was
power.
And so whether
he called himself,
What happens, I think, with a lot of people, and we see it even today in a lot of the Christian ministries, is you realize that you can influence people, and so you can take that influence and you can use it for good or you can use it for evil. Well, in his case, he realized that he had this magnetism and he had this power, which he really did, to manipulate people, to actually manipulate people to drink Kool-Aid with cyanide and to take people out of the United States of America and a pretty good lifestyle probably for most of them and move them to a jungle. So life had to be difficult in the beginning because you had to build that place basically, didn't you?
Right. And so, I mean, I think what happened was, you know, he was very persuasive and he was very protective. I mean, so much of his persona was, okay, you need a lawyer? Here's a lawyer who can talk to you. You need to write an appeal to the disability board. Here's somebody who can help you with that. You need to see a nurse. Here's your nurse. You need to have food. Here's a soup kitchen. So in many ways, he established himself as somebody who was going to be there for whatever a person needed. So that was his public persona. And so he did that. I mean, he had the kids in the temple all wanted to change their last names to Jones.
Really?
He had already adopted 5 or 6 kids, but all the kids knew him to be an inclusive and, you know, friendly and, you know, wonderful guy who was going to give them a hand. So in his public persona, it just wasn't obvious early on that there was this whole other side of him.
Yeah.
And so the dysfunctional part of him, as he got more power, the power corrupted him even more. And he surrounded himself with people who didn't question, who said, okay, Jim's going to protect me, so I'm going to abdicate all my, you know, rights and critical thinking. So
yeah.
He can make the decision. His decisions are better than my decisions. And so that's the kind of people he either gathered them around or he belittled people with the critical thinking skills as being treasonous or traitors or, you know, not receptive to the truth. And so they were kind of mimicked and put down. So
that's an interesting fact, if you wouldn't mind elaborating on that, because we see that so much today, is that people, they lay aside their critical thinking and they look to leaders to solve their problems, but just explain that a little bit.
I think in a way I'm a perfect example because I moved into people's temple, and for the first, I am an atheist. I was an atheist before I joined the temple. I was an atheist in the temple, and I was an atheist after.
Wow.
If ever I was going to not be a person of faith, it was after November 18th of 1978. So my orientation was looking for a political leader who could be a voice for the people who didn't want to be bullied by murderers and you know, people who wanted something else.
And now, that's interesting because Jim Jones portrayed himself as a minister. I mean, he used the Bible as a prop. And he wore a collar.
And then he was an ordained minister of the Disciples of Christ.
Yeah.
And he had read the Bible front and back. So you could have any Bible scholar get into a discussion with Jim, and Jim was going to win. Because Jim had put the time in to really know exactly what was in the Bible and be able to quote more. I mean, he was really a brilliant man. And so I think early on he saw that there was power in him learning about the Bible. And so he did set to work and learned it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so
Go ahead.
So he wasn't, you know, my thinking that, you know, I've kind of come to, because my opinions evolve over these years. It's been 36 years. We just had the 36th anniversary. And so what I think is that when Jim was in a dysfunctional home and he'd travel around and he'd go to different churches, I think he saw that the position of the minister or reverend or pastor or whatever, you know, whatever denomination he was in, he would see a person up in front and everybody else was mesmerized by what the person was saying. He said, I want that position.
The reason
I want to be a leader to bring people to the faith, it was never that. It was, I want that position that everybody shuts up when I'm talking and looks at me with reverence. That's what I want. And so I think that motivated him throughout his whole life.
Yeah, well, what did he do before he was a preacher, so to speak?
Well, no, he was a lay preacher, and he was involved in churches growing up, and he was in Lynn, Indiana, and in Indianapolis, and so he, you know, as soon as he got out of college, and he married Marceline, who was a registered nurse, and, you know, started adopting his kids, he and his wife were the first white couple to adopt a black child in the state of Indiana.
Yeah.
I mean, early on, you know, he was very progressive. He pushed the envelope. He wouldn't take no for an answer. I mean, he really wanted to make a position known. So he was, you know, all those things. And he was kind of a lay preacher, and he started doing, preaching before he even had his title. But then he did open a church. He was invited in to open a church or to be a minister in a church. And he said that he wasn't going to have a church that wasn't integrated. This was in the early 60s. And so half the congregation walked out, and the other half remained true to him and came out with him to California. So early on, he saw that his power was going to come from churches, I think.
Yeah. he had some crazy sermons. One of them I listened to, he said, well, I don't have to die on a cross, and I'm going to live for you. And the way he talked, it was really bizarre. Looking at him now, and but you could see that there was definitely some kind of a spirit operating there, which later on, when you look at the photographs of him, he goes from looking, you know, pretty normal, and then he's always in these dark glasses, and then he kind of looks drugged up, like really heavily drugged up. Especially in the pictures you see of him in Jonestown, but and mad. You know, he just looks like he's going mad. And during this time, though, what did you think of the way he was behaving?
Well, you know, he talked about himself as being a revolutionary, and I think that what we know about almost any movement that gets off the ground, you have to have total zealots who, you know, really pushed through obstacles and the yell butts and all that. And so I think that he wanted to inspire us to be totally focused on this picture of having a utopian community. And so along with that was, you know, he wasn't happy if somebody wasn't giving their all. And so, you know, I mean, so there is this pressure to be the best revolutionary ever on all of us if we wanted to be considered loyal to him. So he set up this standard of behavior that if you want to have a position in people's temple and be close to this power source, you need to kind of suck it up and just work your butt off. And so that was the tone of things. The other thing he did, though, that was interesting is he'd have three or four or five sermons every week. And you know, and I know that life is very complicated. To get a night off is really difficult. So
yeah.
He knew that everybody was, you know, juggling all these balls and working several jobs and all that. So he said, okay, if I'm going to get people to come out and donate their money and everything four nights a week, I have to make every service different. I have to make it so that if they miss a service, they're going to feel bad because they won't know what I did. So he became dramatic about things. You know, he'd fly off the stage and jump down or throw the Bible or, you know, he'd do all these, like, kind of gimmicky, thespian kinds of things to make sure he had everybody's attention.
Yeah.
And then, to draw people in. Otherwise, what would you do four times a week? Why would you go to the same man speaking in the same place four times a week for three or four hours? You know, nobody
yeah.
has time for that unless he creates that kind of addiction himself.
So he would speak for 3 or 4 hours?
Oh, I mean, the service would be 3 or 4 hours.
Wow.
So people would get there, you know, like, say on Sunday, people would get there at 10, and then we'd have the choir. I mean, a lot of churches go on many hours. So they'd have the choir, they'd have the testimonies, they'd have the first collection, and maybe somebody else, a guest speaker or something, although he usually didn't have guest speakers because he never wanted to share the limelight. But,
yeah.
You know, and then he would come on, and he might talk for an hour and a half with breaks and songs in between and stuff like that. And so people would get out around 3 or 4 on Sundays.
Yeah.
And then during the week, you know, it wouldn't be that long, but he wanted people to come every time.
Yeah.
And for the offering, because he was getting them off the streets and out of harm's way from one point of view. And also because, you know, his ego really liked to have a full house. So
yeah.
For many reasons, he would do this.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting testimonies. What was the testimonies? Because I see one picture of a lady. She's holding a sign, I believe in Jim Jones. Now, usually
uh-huh.
a Christian person says, I believe in Jesus Christ. I trust Jesus
uh-huh.
Christ. But, yeah, it was like, I believe in Jim Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So what was
yeah,
the testimony service like? Were they praising the things that he did for them?
Well, you know, I mean, the whole point of testimony is to give credit to Jim. But,
yeah.
Like, people would say, you know, I got out of prison, and, you know, it was my third time in prison, and I didn't really know what direction to go to. And I started coming to meetings with Jim Jones, and now I'm a bus driver, and I, you know, travel around the city, and I take care of my children, and I don't use drugs. I mean, you know, people have so many different issues. Or it could be, you know, I tried to get on disability because, you know, this chronic condition, and they wouldn't do it. Finally, Jim had me sit down with the attorney, and he contacted the disability, and I got my disability after trying for 5 years. Or, you know, I'm a grandparent, I'm taking care of my grandkids, and my kids have been in prison or have been on drugs, and now they've straightened up and they've started taking responsibility for their kids. And then he also had a healing ministry. Where, you know.
What?
A healing ministry? Yeah. And so we went around the country and would have services where he would do healing. And early on, I saw the healings and I saw the people and I talked to them for the next, you know, 7 years, and they swore by the healing. They were absolutely true.
Oh,
also, though, especially towards the end, he was making up. You know, he would have his again, close, you know, secretaries and mistresses behave as if they're disabled or have them, in makeup and everything, looking like they're disabled, and then he heals them. So early on, you know, I'm absolutely sure, and, you know, I don't even believe in God. I don't even believe in anything that I could put that on. I saw healings, and so I don't question that at the beginning. But towards the end, they were pretty much all fabricated. I mean, he was exhausted. The drugs he was on, the adventures or misadventures he was involved with, everything was, you know, taking its toll on him. So the healings were one of those things that more and more towards the end were completely, you know, phony.
Yeah. So was he, when did you start to notice the insanity? I mean, it, obviously he always bordered on insanity from what I could see of him, but when did you really start to notice that?
Well, you know, I'm really embarrassed to say. So my life was, I lived in Redwood Valley for 7 years. In March of 1977, Jim asked me to go to Guyana, and I'd be kind of on the sales team. I would buy all the supplies for Jonestown and send them up to Jonestown, which was 24 hours by boat, into Jonestown. They'd empty off everything, send the boat back, and I'd fill it up again. So when I first went to Guyana, I lived in Georgetown for almost a year. So I didn't see that much of Jim because he was in Jonestown.
Yeah.
He came in the summer of 77 and stayed in Jonestown. So I didn't.
Why did they
him.
Wind up in Guyana? I mean, why did they pick that place?
You know, it was a socialist government, and the government was happy to have us help populate the Northwest District in Guyana because they had a border dispute with Venezuela. It was close to the Venezuelan border. And so there was a border dispute on that property, and the Guyanese government wanted to get a population in there that couldn't just be pushed off. So that was a perfect place. Plus, it's English-speaking. It was half black, you know, half East Indian, and then a sprinkling of Chinese and white. It was in the tropics. It was the most beautiful country, really just a lovely, wonderful country. It's, you know, beautiful, like, you know, the remote parts of Hawaii. So
yeah.
There's all this.
So did he buy that land? Did people... did you have people at People's Temple that were wealthy?
You know, he leased the land from the government. And we did have people who People's Temple wealthy. Yeah, so we leased the land. We owned the land in San Francisco and Los Angeles, but we leased the land in Guyana. And we did have people who were part of People's Temple who were wealthy. And for the most part, they would, you know, people donated their houses and emptied their bank accounts and, you know, spent the money they had so that they could live communally in a community that was really beginning to be wonderful in Guyana. I loved every minute of it, but, you know, I was young and it was just a new adventure. Like
It was a new adventure. But mm-hmm. when you went there, there was nothing there as far as were there any buildings at all?
Some of us who were on the Planning Commission, which was a group Jim had of about 90 people during the early 70s, he took us all down there for Christmas of 1975 so we could see the territory. And so at that point, there were just two or three buildings. So then we all came back, and then 2 years later, we had a crew stay down there and level the land and start building and things like that. So when I went back 2 years later, there were probably five or six large dormitory buildings and cafeteria and things like that.
People lived in dormitories then.
Yeah, so what we had is we had a pavilion, which was kind of like, you know, the church building, but nothing was closed in because it's tropical. You didn't, you know, there wasn't a cold season. So we had the open pavilion, and then we had five dormitories for seniors and people who were disabled, and that was really close to the pavilion and the food tent where we all ate. So they were close in and close to the showers and everything. And then a further walk, like 1,000 yards down the path, we started building cottages. And by November 1978, there were 52 cottages, and we were building one a week. So,
wow.
You know, it turned out that we had, you know, at the beginning, it was very primitive, but really each week, with all of us working our hearts out, it was getting, each week it was significantly better and less primitive.
Yeah.
Because
so why did you think that this was going to be some sort of utopia besides living in San Francisco?
You know, it was a utopia. The people who were closest to Jim, you know, how I said earlier, Jim's secretaries and mistresses, they were really infected by all the maladies Jim had, you know, the insanity, the ego, the personality disorder, all of that. But for the rest of us in Jonestown, you know, probably 875 or 850 people, the community itself was thriving and wonderful. I mean, we had completely broken down racism. And you could see it, you know, we came as kind of black and white, a lot of Native Americans, quite a few Hispanics, some Asians. And by the time we were there, you know, even a year and a half or 2 years, all the babies that were being born in Jonestown, and we had some beautiful babies, were all different colors, all mixed. So, you know, we may have come from the United States, which was really a pretty racist country at that time. Martin Luther King's dream had not caught on in many parts of the United States. And so when we got to Guyana, it was completely mixed. And it was people of all races and religions, and all professions. So the people who were in the schools were great teachers. Our kids were learning a lot. The people who, you know, had other skills were teaching people, and people were getting trained. And so for all of us who were not in Jim's inner circle, you know, many of us loved it there. I loved it there. And you asked me earlier, when did I see that Jim was really, you know, out of sorts? I had even stopped watching what Jim was doing, because he was kind of off on his own. His cottage was not near the other people's cottages. He would come to have sermons. But, you know, I was an enthusiastic member of the community.
Yeah.
And so,
you didn't really see him that much. He kind of had his own life there.
Yeah, and when he came around, you know, it's kind of like, there are a couple things. One is, you know, when you're with somebody who is increasingly mentally ill, you don't see the little changes day by day.
Yeah.
And so it's not like, you know, when you see somebody you haven't seen for 6 months and you say, whoa, that person's gained a lot of weight. In a way, Jim's insanity was the same way. It seemed to move slowly, and so it didn't hit us that he was completely off at the end, because it was such a gradual change for him. So, anyway, for me, I did not see it. I just thought, you know, at some point he'd die, somebody else would take over, or not, and we'd have this wonderful community.
Yeah.
And so I think that a lot of us felt, you know, whatever happened with Jim, it's kind of like an aging grandfather in the back bedroom. You know, he comes out, makes a stroll around, and goes back, and then you just live your life.
Yeah.
And so it's not like he was in charge of every piece of minutia. And he seemed to be pretty content controlling the, you know, now this group of 20 who were close to him. He seemed to, you know, be getting along. It appeared like he was getting along, just totally manipulating those 20. And the rest of us were pretty much left on our own.
Yeah. What about his wife? How long had he been married? Was her name Marceline?
Yeah, he was married to Marceline since before he came out, you know, probably it might have been the end of the 50s or early 60s, and they had 5 children together. And, you know, I mean, she's just in a difficult position because Jim had mistresses from the very beginning. And so I think that Marceline was totally in love with her children and would have done anything.
Yeah. She was kind of a sad figure, really.
Yeah, I mean, she was always, always, like, trying to run interference because, you know, Jim was a madman. And so, I mean, I think she really felt like she had to be around because she needed to be between Jim and the kids, whatever plan he had. Because I'm sure she saw his insanity long before the rest of us.
Yeah. How did she, though, the thing that's really odd about her is, you know, that she allowed her children. Did they all die that day?
You know, two of her children died in Jonestown. One person never went to Jonestown because she left the church. And then Jim's two sons were in Georgetown with me. They were on the basketball team, led at a national competition. So they were out of town. So several of her children did die in Jonestown, Lou and Agnes.
Yeah.
So but I think that she took to feel that her mission in life was protecting her children. And so whatever else was going on, she was steadfast in being with them. And so I think if she had wanted to take Jim on anything, he was so powerful. I mean, I think that we do see that around, that when you have a powerful person, you know, people around him don't feel that they could be listened to if they went to authorities or anything. You know, I think kind of like whistleblowers.
Yeah.
Say, okay, whatever it means to do it, I have to be a whistleblower. I think she felt that her best position was to be there with those kids.
So the two sons, then, are you in contact with them at all?
Yes. We're good friends, Jimmy and Steven.
How are they doing today?
You know, I think today that they're doing fine. They both have the burden, you know, of being Jim's sons. But I mean, they're just wonderful guys. And Steven, Jim and Marceline had adopted five or six children. And then Steven was the homegrown son, and his name is Steven Gandhi Jones. And so when I was in Guyana, Steven was on the basketball team, and he was involved in things that really Jim never set up. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with Father Divine, but Father Divine had talked that he would pass the mantle on to somebody else. Well, Jim never had any plans to pass the mantle on to anybody. And so, in a way, even though Steven was his son and Jimmy was his son, there was never really much conversation about who might take over. And I think part of that is, you know, if you're looking at a group and say, okay, is this a cult or not a cult? One flag is, if there's no plan to pass on leadership, that's a flag. You know, I mean, if you say, I am everything to you, and
that's
not
a real big flag. You know, that should have been a big flag for people, because just like I said, listening, I had never really listened to any of his sermons. Uh-huh. So this week I was doing a little research, and I was shocked at the things he was saying. He's like, I don't have to go to the cross. I mean, he's essentially mocking Jesus Christ. I don't have to die for you. I'm going to live for you. Mm-hmm. In other words, I'm going to be everything for you. Just look to me. Uh-huh. I'm the answer to everything. I mean, that was a huge red flag. And then when he called himself God, that was a real huge red flag. But, you know, these kind of things everybody has to watch out for, you know, believers and non-believers alike, because we can't ever make a human being, put a human being on that level where they take the place of God or they call themselves God. And it usually doesn't end well, which it didn't at all end well in Jonestown. But did you ever in your wildest imagination think that that was going to be what was going to happen?
You know, I never did, and I was just communicating with somebody else about this. Like, if you had a child or a loved one who wanted to join a group, you'd advise them, don't let it be like Jim Jones. Don't let it be like People's Temple. And you'd refer back to People's Temple as a wealth of knowledge of what to stay away from, right?
Yeah.
But at that time, there was no reference. There was never a religious leader that people had respected who then turned around and killed almost 1,000 people.
Yeah.
There was no,
that's
said
true.
It was like unbelievable. It was so far out of anything that we knew in recent history. We just could, you know what I mean? It was not even in our thinking that whatever drama Jim did and whatever thespian or whatever calling himself God, whatever was going on, never did it occur to us that really he was going to put us in harm's way. and have people tell them. Never.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, I mean, we've learned so much from people's temple. And the realization I just had lately is, you know, I had my own traumas. I had my own fight for survival. And, you know, then finally after 20 years, I said, okay, I have to get my life together. I went back to school. I became a teacher. I was a teacher for 20 years. I wrote my book. I did what I needed to do. But, you know, I had to survive all of that. I just think that part of it was so far out of any kind of thinking. There's no inkling in our minds that this protector, this person who had taught us to be revolutionaries and taught us to live simply and taught us not to, you know, fling around diamonds and all that, the same person was the same one who came back around and had 1,000 people die.
Yeah. And you did put this in a book, your book, Jonestown Survivor, An Insider's Look. And
yes.
Where can people get that book if they wanted to read your whole story?
You know, it's you can get it. I have a blog and a website, www.jonestownsurvivor.com. So it's on Kindle and ebook. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it off my website. My publisher was iUniverse. And also, just last month, I came out with an Audible book.
Oh,
so you can get the audio book from ACX.
Yeah.
So so you can get it all those different ways.
Yeah. It's, looking back on it now, even in the day when it happened, it was so hard to fathom that something like that happened. And even when I don't know if it was the day before or a few days before, what he's actually showing the Kool-Aid. So he's showing the supplies they have there. And he said, and here's the Kool-Aid. And you know, just to look at that and then to think about what happened, it was just awful. And he shot himself. Was he the only one that was shot?
No, so it turned out that at the end, you know, people had died or were dying of the poison, and he and his secretary were still alive, one of his secretaries, Annie Moore. And so I think that they were the last two who were alive, and he was shot and she was shot. And so, you know, there's not a witness who can say for sure what happened. My theory, which is not shared by everybody, but my theory is that she shot him and then shot herself.
Oh, because maybe he didn't plan to die. Did he plan to die? Do you know, did he plan to die that day?
No, I actually would be the last person to know what he planned. I don't know what he planned. He didn't save, you know, his children in Jonestown. And so I can't imagine that he would think about surviving with, like, his mistress and his kids. Everybody was dead. So I have to think he was going to die, but I also realized he probably didn't want to go the way of the poison. He said, I want it quick and dirty, and that's what happened.
Yeah. So how long were you there then in Jonestown, and why weren't you there that day?
So I was in Georgetown about 10 months. I lived in Georgetown but traveled back and forth sometimes. But I lived in Georgetown for a year, and then I moved into Jonestown for the next 8 or 9 months. And I worked on an agricultural crew, and I taught Spanish in the school and worked in the law office and, you know, did lots of different jobs around Jonestown. And I actually loved both of them equally. I thought it was just awesome to watch as the cottages expanded and people had a little more space. And, you know, it was just, I was really happy both places. So at the end of October, you know, it was very remote in Jonestown. So there was the radio that Jim had, like a world band on, the kind of the, you know, with the Morse code. And there's the radio that was the communication. But there were really no phones, no computers, no cell phones, none of that. So the only information we got was what, you know, Jim would hear, translate to his paranoia, and then tell the community. So really, we had very little information about what was really going on in the world.
Yeah.
So we were in Queenstown. This huge fire was going on in San Francisco, and people started discovering some of the things Jim had done. You know, he had been arrested in a sting operation in Los Angeles in 72 or 73. He, you know, was doing a power play behind the scenes and had manipulated quite a few politicians in San Francisco. He was involved in a lot of different things, and that was beginning to be discussed in San Francisco. There was a group of concerned relatives in San Francisco who were bringing it out, and an investigative reporter from the New West magazine. And so all of this was going on in San Francisco, but we didn't know about it. It was all hush in Joseph. So at the end of October, Jim asked me if I would go into the house in Georgetown and relieve the people who were still in Georgetown so they could switch off and come out to Jonestown. So it just happenstance he sent me into Georgetown. And I was there with the basketball team. About 50 of us lived in this 4 or 5 or 6 bedroom house in Georgetown.
Yeah.
You know, like sardines, but, you know, but we were, you know, we were all brothers and sisters. It wasn't like it was an issue. We had fun, kind of, wherever we worked hard and kind of had fun. So
yeah.
I moved into Georgetown. Then when Congressman Ryan came with his whole entourage, I was in Georgetown. So when Congressman Ryan came to town, he climbed over our back fence and came into the house in Georgetown and greeted us and said, you know, I'm a congressman. I just wanted to see how things are going. And really, Jim had set it up with all the people who loved Jonestown in the house. So when Ryan said, how do you like it here? You know,
oh, so you knew he was coming?
No, we didn't know he was coming.
Oh, you didn't? Oh.
We didn't. Jim knew he was coming, but I didn't know. So, I mean, Jim and his secretaries knew. But what Jim had done is he had set up the people in the house to be people who had no complaints about Jim.
Yeah.
You know, he had set it up. Like, if you're going to be a PR person, you're going to be in the house in Georgetown when Congressman Ryan comes.
Yeah.
So then the
How many
day,
days was Congressman Ryan there?
Well, he was in Georgetown. He came to our house a couple of days before, and then Jim kept saying, no, no, you can't go to Jonestown. You can't go. And so Jim booked, I just found out, Jim booked all the airlines flying into Port Kaituma and Matthews Ridge, the two airport, not airports, the two holes in the rainforest where the planes could land. He booked all the flights so that there was no plane that they could take in. So Congressman Ryan stayed in Georgetown for a couple of days trying to work it out, and finally Jim said, okay, you can come. So then he let Ryan and, you know, a group of 12 or so come in to Jonestown. And so they came into Jonestown, and Congressman Ryan, they put on a whole show because he had so many talented people in Jonestown. I mean, we had wonderful musicians and, I mean, just the best. And so we put on this whole show for Congressman Ryan, and he stood up at the end and he said, you know, I can tell by looking at you and looking what you've accomplished and everything that many of you love living in Jonestown and that you're really delighted to be here. And then he stepped down from the podium and people started handing him notes saying, you know what, I need to leave. Jim won't let me leave. Help me get out of here. I need to go with you. Don't have me wait till next week for another plane. I need to go with you when you leave.
Yeah.
And so there were 18 people who wanted to leave with Congressman Ryan.
Yeah, 18 out of the 900 or so.
Right. I mean, like, out of, like, 920, 18 wanted to leave. I mean, that's, like, nothing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, like, I mean, really.
Well, why didn't he want them to leave? What was the big issue? Like, I didn't know that there was only 18 people that wanted to leave.
You know,
why didn't he want the 18 people to leave?
Well, one thing was it hurt his ego that anyone would want to leave. You know, it was like he was incredulous that anybody could leave the paradise he set up. So that the part of it is he's completely dysfunctional in even thinking. I mean, some people just wanted to go live the lifestyle in San Francisco.
Yeah.
There was nothing personal. So,
yeah.
But he, everything that went on, he took personally. So the main thing is he felt that they were abandoning him or not giving him a chance to make it up. So there was this lunatic part there was absolutely.
Oh, well, yeah, lunatic, is, yeah.
Yeah. So that was really, that was the main reason. He didn't want people to look to someone else for, you know, sustenance or something. So, and then the other part was he thought people would go back and talk about Jonestown and it would get a bad rap. And
yeah.
People who wanted to come would be talked out of coming. And he
yeah,
really
but actually he was
people.
Probably eventually going to be arrested. That's what it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. See, I mean, there's so many different issues. The other thing is that there were some custody battles, custody battles about children who were taken into Jonestown, either by one of the parents, leaving the other parent out, and including one of the custody battles that Jim had taken John Stone to Jonestown, and there was a custody battle with that. And so while the issue with John Stone was being resolved, and his parents had come to Georgetown and talked to government officials told Jim to stay in Jonestown. So he was kind of under house arrest in Jonestown.
Oh.
So here's this guy with this tremendous ego where thousands of people would come three nights a week and listen to him for hours. And here he was under house arrest in this primitive community, and he'd have 900 people come and listen to him, but a third were under 18, a third were over 60, and the ones in the middle were worked to death, and so everybody fell asleep. So he probably felt like he was having a sermon, preaching a sermon to farm workers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so if you can see the two pictures, you know, here are people, you know, flaunting that they're close to him, wearing diamonds, jewels, donating lots of money. And then the other end of it, these 900 people who are like asleep on their feet, not listening to him, dozing while he's saying all these things while he's under house arrest. Like
yeah.
His ego was just shattered.
Yeah, what about the drugs? Now, didn't anyone notice that the guy looked drugged? And what kind of drugs was he using? Do you know?
You know, I don't know what drugs he was using, but you know, these same secretaries who, for one thing, were providing the drugs, because he was a drug addict, you know, probably before he left San Francisco. But, you know, once he got to Guyana more, and I think he was on drugs for, you know, medical issues, and then also he was abusing drugs. So, and I don't know when it got so heavy, but if he wasn't coherent, they just wouldn't let him out of the house.
Oh.
So when he was, like, falling down drugs, or not able to, you know, speak or something, they just wouldn't let him out of the house.
Yeah.
So we never saw him at his worst. They saw him at his worst. But then, you know, they were infected like he was, saying, yeah, well, he's, you know, the brilliant mind and we have to protect him or whatever goes on in that, you know, kind of relationship where you have a drug addict and people enable him all around.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, they're,
you know,
really enabling. So did he actually live with all these different women?
You know, I think he had a cottage, and then the secretaries lived close by. And but, you know, not on the beaten track. So, there was never a time, like, I wasn't even sure where his cottage was. Because, I mean, you were in the primitive area. It's not like there's streetlights and numbers on the cottages and stuff, but I don't remember ever even knowing where his cottage was. I never saw
it. Yeah.
So all the times that he was really drugged up, then the secretaries would give him the balance. Like I did hear he was on uppers and downers. He was on downers to sleep and uppers so that he could, you know, be articulate. And so he was always on something going up and down. So, and I don't really know enough about drugs to know which specific drugs they are.
Yeah, he
know.
Looked like he was shooting heroin or something. He was he was really heavily drugged, especially that day that Congressman Ryan was there. And
that's
he
right.
was
that
slurring
was.
His words.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was totally incoherent that day when he was talking about Vern Gosney and how people lie. Yeah, he was completely over the top, and which is why I think, you know, he and the secretaries had already come up with a plan. They knew exactly what they were going to do. Each person had their job lined up for the day. You know, there was no surprise ever in Jonestown. Like, everything was planned. There wasn't ever a time that there was a spontaneous action. Like, when I first came back, you know, I thought, okay, so Jim went crazy that last day, and they said, okay, what are we going to do? Let's get out this poison. And it was all spontaneous that last day. I really did think that for a while. Nothing spontaneous. The poison was in Jonestown probably as much as a year before that happened. We had a license for the cyanide to make jewelry, but we never made the jewelry. So
that's how we got the cyanide?
Yeah. So he had the cyanide, he had the Flavor Aid, he had all the different things. Although, I mean, we drank Flavor Aid at meals, so we did drink Flavor Aid also. But, you know, I mean, so but nothing was last minute. They knew where the vat was, where the juice was, where the poison was, where the red. They knew how to bring it out. They knew the plan. Everything was planned to the last, you know, degree.
Yeah. Nothing, so their people helped him. He had people help him.
But he was incoherent. He couldn't do any of it. So
yeah.
He had a secretary.
Oh, obviously,
and
yeah.
People. Yeah.
Yeah.
So not only did they help him, they did it. He didn't do it. They did it. These people who had been infected by his insanity, they did
it. Now, there were some people that actually survived that day who were, I guess, witnesses of what happened.
Yeah, I think that we figured there were about 20 people who were in Jonestown who one way or the other got out. One was a friend of mine, Leslie Wagner Wilson. She wrote her book, Slavery of Fate. And she was in Jonestown, and she took her son. That morning, she and 12 other people went on what they called a picnic in planning to never come back. So she took her son, who was the youngest survivor from Jonestown, and they walked 30 miles to just get the hell out of there. So she survived, and so she's here, and she wrote her book, Slavery of Faith. And then three people were sent with the money to leave Jonestown and take it to the Soviet embassy in town. And two people, such as a senior man, walked up to one of the guards and said, you know, I don't want to die today. And the guy said, okay, go ahead. And he just walked into the forest and stayed lost until everything was over. And then
said the money. Now, the money that they had, they did have. How much money was there?
Well, you know, I think that they did. You know, they looked at all the places around the world where there's people's simple money, and they came and property owned and everything, and they came up with about $20 million in assets.
Wow.
So that day, Jim had three men, actually not really big, strong, hefty men, but three, you know, kind of not strong, healthy men, carry three big suitcases full of money. Into the rain, into the forest to walk to get someplace to get, you know, ludicrous. First of all, it was too heavy to carry. There had been a huge rain. You had to get through the mud. So the three guys just dropped the money, you know, put it someplace where they could come back to it, and left, you know, went into town. So they were pulled into town. They took the Guyanese Defense Force or whoever back. They got the money. And so, anyway, so they survived. So the three of them, and the 13 people who went on the picnic, and then Hyacinth Thrash was in bed, and she just covered herself up with her sheet and, you know, tried to sleep through it and slept until the next day. And she wrote a wonderful book called The Onlyest One Alive, which was really wonderful. And so, and those are the people who survived Jonestown. Oh, and then two young guys were smart enough to figure out, they made an excuse to go get something for somebody, and they snuck off into the woods. So they were able to survive.
Yeah.
And everybody else died. Everybody else in Jonestown died.
Yeah. Now, so who has the money today? Did the children inherit the assets, or was it confiscated?
It was taken over by the U.S. the government, and they put a conservator in charge. Judge Fabian in San Francisco. And so he collected all the assets, and then people filed claims of wrongful death and different claims. And also the government billed the estate for bringing people bringing the bodies back and all that. So for the most part, people who lost relatives who filed claims got more money. And if you were survivors who lost kids, you got a little bit less. But, you know, nobody got, you know, nobody got rich over it. But some people filed the claim, yeah.
Yeah. So the bodies were brought back for burial to this country?
Yeah, so the bodies were brought back to Dover Air Force Base, and they sat there for several months.
Really?
They didn't know what to do with them. Well, because, you know, the relatives of the people who died in Jonestown, a lot of them did not have money.
Yeah.
They didn't have money to bring a casket across the country and take care of that. And also there's a stigma, you know, oh, yeah, you're related to someone in people. It's almost like you couldn't talk about it.
Yeah,
people lost their jobs when they were interviewed on TV.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one guy lost his job because he said, yeah, my mother was there, and his boss fired him because he had any connection. So, I mean, they're all the – it was so difficult. And, you know, it had never happened that one day 900 bodies would be flown in. Like, there's no way to organize it in such a last-minute thing to make it work. So finally, Evergreen Cemetery in Oakland stepped up and said, you know, most of the people are from the Bay Area and this part of California. We'll take them on. And so they brought all the bodies to Oakland, to Evergreen Cemetery. Ron Hallman, who's been great all these years.
Oh, that was nice.
And so he buried them all, and they had a ceremony and everything.
Oh, that was nice.
And so it was really good. And another part about that is, I don't know if you saw, but over the summer, there were they went into an abandoned funeral home in Dover. There, some people were cremated.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, so they found the cremains of 9 people's temple members.
Yeah.
So because I had written about one of them in the Jonestown Report, which is this annual report put out by the Jonestown Institute, an investigator of forensic science contacted me saying, okay, Maude Perkins, you wrote about her, and I have her cremains here. You know of any of her living relatives? So all of the survivors got busy, and we found 7. You know, of the 9 people, we found living relatives for 7 of them. And so some of them were, you know, some of the relatives made arrangements to get the ashes, and the rest were buried at Evergreen Cemetery this year on October 20th. And then when we had our annual ceremony on November 18th, we said more words over them, and we put down sunflowers on where they're buried at the same, you know, adjacent to the Evergreen Cemetery people's.
Yeah. I have a question from someone in the chat room. She asked, did Jim Jones' wife drink the Kool-Aid? Wow. Amazing. So, now, leading up to that day, of course, we know Congressman Ryan was there, and I think he had his secretary there.
He had his administrative assistant, Jackie Speer, who's now Congressman.
Yeah, she made it out a lot. She did live. She was shot, and she did live.
That's right.
Yeah.
Quite a few people were wounded,
Yeah. Now, when he, so it was the night before where they had this kind of party, and then the next day was Congressman Ryan leaving, and was he staying at Jonestown?
Yeah, he stayed overnight in a cottage in Jonestown, and he was leaving the next day. They were delayed a little bit because he called and asked for a third plane to come in to help take the rest of the people who wanted to go. So they were delayed a little with that, and then there was a huge thunder shower, and they were delayed by that. So he got a late start leaving. But then they all loaded on the truck and went to the airstrip at Fort Kaituma. And, you know, we say airstrip, but really it was just, you know, some blacktop, you know, like, you know, 1,000 feet.
Yeah, there
of
wasn't
out.
Much there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But did any of you know that there was these guns there? Did you know that Jim Jones had these thugs that worked for him that actually shot people? Because it's probably not the first time he did anything weird like that.
You know,
I'm sure there was other things that went on.
You know, the thing about the guns, at one point in Redwood Valley, there was a trade-in for guns, or I don't know, Redwood Valley or San Francisco, that people said, okay, trade in your guns, we'll melt them down and we'll give you this. Whatever it is, food you see. So there are like 30 guns in Jonestown. But they were, you know, old, some of them were like just old crappy guns. There was no like high-powered fancy gun, but there were rifles. And nothing like that had ever happened. No one was ever shot in People's Temple. Never, never, never. There was never any kind of overt violence like that. There was intimidation. There, you know, Jim would be threatening from the pulpit about, you know, people who leave and tell lies. Like, you know, it's all words. There was no act that would prepare us for that. And, you know, the thugs, actually, they were the people who were our brothers and sisters. I mean, there was no mercenary army there. Those were all people who grew up in People's Temple. And so,
how do you think that Jim got those people to go shoot Congressman Ryan and the rest of the people there? How did that happen?
You know? We were just all totally brainwashed into thinking that here we had a community where people were, you know, except for those 18 who left, you know, people were happy with what was going on. They felt that our kids were out of harm's way and away from the drugs in the U.S. and violence and everything. We had this community, and we had moved away from the U.S. government, and yet now the U.S. government was coming in and telling us what to do and how to change things and stuff. And so Jim just made it seem like the U.S. government was the enemy.
Yeah.
That we were the people's army, and that was the enemy. And that Congressman Ryan was just the first stage of them completely coming in and taking over the whole community. So he made them looked at in such an evil way that, you know, he just set it up that that way. And I think he said, you know, this is our only chance to be independent. Is to get rid of these people before they take their stories back.
Oh.
Because they weren't thugs. Sorry.
I don't know if we'll give her a couple minutes, but I don't know if the listeners remember. But anyway, if you all wanted to go on YouTube and look at the news reports and at the video, you can see Congressman Ryan. He looks like a very pleasant person. And he didn't seem like he wanted to do them any harm at all. It just so happened that while he was there, that people were passing him notes and telling him that they wanted to leave. And they wanted to go back to the USA and live their lives. And for some reason, it set Jim Jones off, but like Laura said, it had been planned. It wasn't a spontaneous event because the cyanide was there, the vats were there, the Kool-Aid was there, and the people were in place. These women that surrounded themselves around Jim Jones were there to distribute the Kool-Aid, which his own wife took, and two of his children that day. So, I mean, thank God some of his children escaped.
I think that I've lost my train of thought. I think that at that stage, you know, we were totally exhausted. Jim had really, for all these months, been filling us with information about how, you know, the world really was out to get us because we represented everything they weren't. We were an integrated community. You know, we had this whatever freedom. We had branched out. We weren't under their control. And so, really, I think that in a lot of communities and political movements, the leaders try to make a stark difference between what's going on in this community and the enemies, you know.
Yeah, we're the only ones. Yeah, uh-huh. I noticed that in one of Jim Jones had made a reference to the Nation of Islam. I went over and looked at some video from Farrakhan. He does the same thing. He kind of imitates Jim Jones with "It's us against the world," and "I'm so persecuted because people are talking about me." And really, you know, who was really doing anything to Jim Jones? You know, okay, maybe people were talking about him, but who was really doing anything to him? Nobody was really doing anything to him except, you know, in the end, he probably was going to be arrested. And like you said, he was under house arrest. So he probably knew that it was all going to come tumbling down.
Yeah,
and so he decided he was going to take everybody with him. But how do you think he did that? How did he talk these people? Because there was 900 people, so it had to take some time for everybody to drink this cyanide and to watch.
Right.
They were all watching each other die.
You know, I think what we know from the final tape is that, you know, what I was saying before, here are these people who are completely remote, so they don't have a reality check with people who were not under Jim's thumb. So, and, you know, Jim had protected them. He'd gotten their kids out of prison. He had, you know, taken them out of harm's way. So there was a relationship, a dependence on Jim that he had helped each and every one somehow. So a lot of the things that happened later were based on people trusted him and had this faith that he wouldn't put them in harm's way. So when he said, you know, we don't have any choice, they took that to heart, saying, you know, we must not have a choice, otherwise Jim wouldn't say it. So he was a credible leader at that moment. And then he said, you know, we have conspired to shoot a congressman. He didn't say, I conspired with my, you know, secretaries and mistresses. He said, we. So he said, we have conspired to kill a congressman. Every life will never be the way we want it to be. We'll never be left alone now. We can never go back. You can't go back to your relatives. They won't have anything to do with you. You're going to be arrested. Your kids are going to be put in foster care. We already know about the foster care system in San Francisco. It's collapsed. You know, you don't have any money in the bank. You don't have a house to go to. I sold it to pay for Jonestown. You're going to go back penniless with legal fees. Your kids are going to be taken away from you. Your relatives won't know what to do with you. They won't have anything to do with you because you abandoned them in the middle of the night to come here. So you have no place to go. And so he did that, coercing people for an hour and a half. And then towards the end of that, he started the secretaries out giving the poison to the youngest children. And the children were over on the side. So as he's persuading these adults who are in the congregation, on the side, he's already poisoning and killing the children. So there's not really any way, you know, you can't be a mother and think, okay, I allowed my child to drink poison and things are going to be okay, I'm going to go home.
Yeah.
So at the point that he started killing the children, nobody, you know, at that point, everybody just stopped. There was no fighting back anymore.
Yeah. What about the people that went and shot the congressman? Did they all die that day?
Yeah, they all came back and just joined the people in the pavilion, and they all died that day too.
Wow. Now, how did the people get rescued? The survivors from Congressman Ryan's party.
They all ran into everybody when there was gunfire on the airstrip. Everybody ran into the forest and stayed there overnight. And so at the airstrip, four people were killed: Congressman Ryan and a former member, Patty Park, and two reporters and photographers were killed at the airstrip. And a lot of other people were shot and wounded and played dead, like Jackie Spear was on the runway. She played dead, you know, so she wouldn't be shot again. But she thought she was going to die. And
yeah.
Then got was shot several times. And Tim Reiterman, who's a, you know, newspaper reporter now, all of them were shot and wounded at the airstrip. But everybody else ran into the rainforest And then the people just got back on the truck and went back to Jonestown where they all died.
Yeah. Wow.
And so while that was happening, you know, I was in Georgetown, and Jim or one of the secretaries called and left a message, okay, everybody's dying in Jonestown. All of you in Georgetown need to commit suicide. And so that message got to the house in Georgetown, and the person, Jim's secretary, who got the message, sent me out to get Jim's sons and the other people at the basketball team, Stephen and Jimmy. And so I brought them back. And so she met with Jimmy and Stephen and three or four other people in the back bedroom and said, Jim said we should all die now. And Stephen Jones, who was 19, said, absolutely not. We're not doing it. It's all over. We're not
wow.
doing this anymore. We're not listening to anything he says. Let me
wow.
get to Jonestown so I can stop it. But, you know, getting to Jonestown, there's no way to get to Jonestown. And it was too late anyway. But he wanted to go to Jonestown and stop his father. But
wow.
he didn't have a chance. But he stops it in the house in Georgetown, except for Jim's secretary, who killed his three children and then killed herself.
Wow.
And that was the first we, the rest of us in the house, knew of it. We had gone out to a political party thing, and we came back, and the guy in the Defense Forces at the house, and they had us sit down, and then they brought out their body bag. And that's
what
when
did you think? What did you think?
Well, you know, we didn't know. I mean, our first thought was that Sharon had killed her three kids herself, but we didn't know why. And then it turned out it was because of the bigger picture of what was going on in Jonestown. And so, you know, and the Guyanese government put a complete news blackout on it. So they didn't even want to discuss it until they could figure out if their government had been complicit. You know, they had to kind of figure out what was going on and what their response was going to be and everything. So there was nothing on the news. There was nothing anywhere for us to figure out what was going on. First we heard 300 people were found, and they said, oh, no, it was 500. Oh, no, it was 900. So there was nothing, you know, the news was just eking its way back to us, and really we didn't know what was going on except that there was some horrible disaster.
Yeah.
So we started calling our relatives back here in the United States, and they had seen it on the news, and so they would tell us what they had seen on the news. But, I mean, you know, the news doesn't have it always right anyway.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But that was how we got our information kind of third hand, never from Guyana for several days, except that the Guyanese Defense Force took over our house. And that always sounds so ominous, but really the Guyanese Defense Force is kind of like the Coast Guard. You know, they're all 17, and you're hoping they're holding the bend facing the right direction. You know what I mean? Like, not threatening. They weren't threatening. And they said,
yeah.
We said, well, what are you doing here? And they said, well, we think we're protecting you from yourself.
Oh.
But we're not sure.
Okay.
But, you know what I mean? Nobody knew. You know,
yeah.
And so, and it turned
I
out
I bet
that
your
one
relatives
people,
back home were frantic.
Yeah, because I called my mother and told her, and I understand my father, when I called him, he went into his bedroom for 3 days. He just couldn't come out to face the world. So
yeah.
And they were the lucky ones because I came home alive.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a miracle.
Other people who lost their kids, like one person was in the grocery line at the store, and she had her four children there. Oh, my God. Horrible.
Horrible. I mean, to this day, the survivors' families, it has to be devastating and almost unbelievable to think about what
That's
occurred
right.
there and how people could watch their children drink poison and then drink poison themselves.
After you watch your children drink poison, whatever happens to you doesn't make any difference. You know what I mean? Like, in other words, once you saw that, it was all over.
Yeah.
Once you saw, yeah, so.
How mad? Did he leave behind any kind of diary or anything like that? Tape recordings?
You know, he had I mean, everything he ever said pretty much was tape recorded. So they have all the hundreds and hundreds of tapes from Jonestown. But the separate, the woman who, you know, was the last one who was alive, Annie Moore, she wrote kind of a suicide note saying something like, "I'm so sorry you made us do this, but we couldn't live in a world where you wouldn't allow us to have our utopia. You had to, you know, keep interfering," or something like that. So she wrote like a really touching letter that kind of explained the insanity right there.
Yeah. Hard. It's hard to explain. It's hard to understand, but we kind of see how history repeats itself. People followed Hitler, and, you know, a madman. And these were intelligent people in Germany and some of the other countries there. And then this man, Jim Jones.
Because, you know, I think the people start with a position or a philosophy that you can understand. Like, you know, Hitler wanted to give Germany back some of its autonomy. You know, Jim wanted to have a world that was just, where it was integrated and racism didn't prevail. And so they have this one kernel that we all get behind, and then for some reason, once it starts going off the track and going insane, we don't like check ourselves and say, "Well, wait, that doesn't fit in the other part. That doesn't make sense." Like, no, I mean, it's like once it's like you give somebody one piece of candy, then they want the whole box.
Maybe that's true.
You get one thing that works so well for us, and then somehow we just disconnect that logic and critical thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, but we see it all the time, even in the, you know, in Christian circles where people follow leaders, and you know, we use the Bible as our guidebook to life, and we base everything we believe on the Word of God. And if it doesn't agree with the Word of God, then we can't agree with it as Christians. But we even see it, you know, you see it so much on television. You know, people follow other people blindly, and you know, the Bible says that God puts in everybody's heart that desire for Him and the desire for eternity. So human beings come along and they try to play God, and they try to play on people's weaknesses. I think that probably one thing about Jim Jones is he could spot people. And he knew how to spot people, and he got them somehow to confide in him or to share with him some of their weaknesses, and then he used that against them, you know, being the kind of person he was.
I mean, he had all the skills of being a con man, but usually a con man is just one-on-one. You know, it's somebody at a grocery store or somebody who wants your, you know, who will save you $1 million if you give them your bank account. But Jim did it for the whole group.
Yeah.
And he figured out, you know, all of it. So, I mean, I think, you know, he was a con man par excellence. He was just so smart. And the other thing I can think about, too, is a lot of times he would get people who were at a crossroads in their lives.
Yeah, that's what it seems like, yeah.
You know, and so, like, if he, like, we, one of the things we did is we traveled all around the country in these Greyhound buses, Greyhound-style buses, and I was a bus driver, and I loved it, but so he would pick up people around the country, even if they had no resources, to say, you know, come work for our cause, come here.
Yeah,
and so, you know, he would pick up people who were kind of at loose ends and looking for a way to make a difference.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just think, you know, he was personally engaging. So you would think, you know, he's doing a great thing. He's
he was a sly.
Yeah.
Demonic, you know, very, you know, demonically possessed person. I mean, in the end, he looked like, you know, he just had stepped up out of hell. You know, he just looked weird. And
that's why it's so strange, because at the beginning, you know, like when I first came and I saw him preaching and I saw Marsland sitting on stage, you know, or sitting on nearby, just adoring him.
Yeah.
You know, appearing to adore him. I mean, even then he had a mistress for 5 years. I mean, he was never, you know, he was never what I thought he was. And so, but for me to go in and see this guy who looks such a straight arrow and with his wife adoring and these great kids and all the kids in the temple wanting his name. I mean, he was, you know, exactly what I would want to follow, is somebody who would, you know, kind of break down the walls and make a difference.
Yeah, well, that was part of that whole, you know, kind of mystique in the 60s and 70s. You know, people were, they'd say, well, I'm trying to find myself. But, you know, reality, I know from my life, the only way I ever found myself was, you know, when I found Jesus Christ and I was born again. And, you know, then I found the truth. I didn't have to search anymore because, you know, it's like the song Amazing Grace says, I was blind, but now I see. So, what you were once blind, but now you see. And so I don't follow people. You know, I like people. I you know, there's certain people I admire, and, you know, I might admire their accomplishments, but I know that God is the only one that loves me. And he gives me unconditional love. I thought it was very strange that, you know, Jim Jones used that. He said, I give you I don't know if it was him that said that. Maybe it was Farrakhan. But anyway, he seemed to project that I'm the one that loves you. I'm the one that's going to protect you. And no human being can do that. So, you know, it's a lesson, I think, you know, the work you're doing and the fact that this has all been documented, and that you kind of keep this thing alive. It helps people to see how wrong things can go when we follow the leader blindly, and we don't think for ourselves and say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. Because I'm sure Jim didn't live like you. You know, yeah, you didn't even know where he lived because his place was off somewhere. And he probably had a better lifestyle than most of the people that attended People's Temple.
You know, he pretty much was true to what he did. The worst complaint I heard about his lifestyle and Diane, of course, besides the drugs. He was the only one on drugs. So that's a whole other thing. But just in terms of the day-to-day, I mean, he had sodas that we didn't have. But in the way, Jonestown, there wasn't any way to live, you know, a penthouse, kind of lifestyle in Jonestown. No matter what you did, it was a primitive existence. And so whether you had soda or not, you know, there wasn't too much you could do to fancy up living 24 hours by boat from the
But he didn't live, well, you know, he didn't mix. He didn't live with everybody, you know. He wasn't going to, you know, set up his place right there in the midst of everybody. He had to go off. So he wasn't really a part of what was going on. He may, you know, maybe he made it appear like that, but, you know, his thinking was diabolical. Like you said, it was a planned event. It was not spontaneous. So he'd been devising this for a long time. He was a diabolical person. And I don't think, you know, none of you knew that, what was going to happen. And it was horrible. It was a horrible event, but I think we can all learn something from history. But we're just about out of time. We just about have a minute left. But Laura, just mention your book again for anybody that wants to look at your website. It's a good website for the history of Jonestown and some of her interviews. Your book, just mention it briefly before we close.
It's a Jonestown Survivor, An Insider's Look. And it's available on Amazon.com or Kindle or ebook, and now an Audible book, too. So it's available on all those. And I have a website, www.jonestownsurvivor.com. I do love your input. If you have questions, you can contact me through my website. I actually get questions, like, just within the last 3 days. I've had, you know, a whole set of questions from people all over the world. So I love your feedback and questions and everything. So I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, so do that. Her website's very, very interesting. It's a good thing for us to remember in the days that we live in, is to keep our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, and not on human beings, because it's a example of what happened here Jonestown with Jim Jones. But Laura, thank you so much, and God bless you richly. Thank you for coming on. I enjoyed it very much.
Good, and I'd love your feedback too. So if you ever have thoughts, drop me a line. I'd love to be in touch.
I will. I'll keep in touch. Okay.
Thanks.
God bless. Bye bye. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I want to thank my guest again, Laura Johnston Cole. And she truly has survived something that none of us will ever survive. And we need to remember her in our prayers. So God bless you all today. Remember, Jesus Christ loves you. He is the way, the truth, and the life. And no man comes to the Father but by him. And Jesus said in the third chapter of John, ye must be born again. Once you're born of your mother, then you must be born again of the Spirit of God. Don't forget to ask Jesus Christ into your life today. Ask him to forgive you of your sins and receive a brand new life. God bless you. Bye-bye. I'm going to a city that's set on a hill. Its ruler and maker is the Lord God above. Oh, I'm going to a city, and it's set on a hill. And someday I'll be in heaven, and there'll be no sorrow there. Oh, I'm going to a city, it lies four square. The gates are made of jasper, and I'll see Jesus there. I'm going to a city, and it's set on a hill. And someday I'll be in heaven, and there'll be no sorrow there. I'll be in heaven, and there'll be no sorrow there. I'm going to a city, it lies four square. The gates are made of jasper, and I'll see Jesus there. I'm going to a city, and it's set on a hill. And someday I'll be in heaven, and there'll be no sorrow there. And someday I'll be in heaven, and there'll be no sorrow there.